Ralph had not seen his father since that stormy night, but he had visited Jordan in his tiny office next door to Mr. Rhodes in the magnificent new Central Diamond Company building on De Beer Street. Perhaps Zuga Ballantyne had not yet recovered from the shock of being deserted by both his sons, but Jordan said that he had not yet left for Cape Town. The thought of his father witnessing this humiliating scene brought dark blood to Ralph's face, and he fired the long trek whip. At least that was one trick he had learned, and bellowed at the span. "Nkosana!" There was a salutation at the level of Ralph's elbow, the mild tone belied by the mocking title. Nkosi was a chief, and Nkosana was the condescending diminutive, usually reserved for a little white boy, an untried child. Ralph turned and glared at the speaker, who went on to explain in the same condescending tone, "Only one beast in 10 will pull in front," he pointed out one of the oxen. "That one there is a lead ox. Any man who knows oxen can see that with both his eyes closed." He was a little black gnome, not as tall as Ralph's shoulder. His face was wrinkled and lined like that of a very old man. His eyes were mere slits in the merry, smiling folds. But his cap of woolly hair and his little goatee beard were unmarred by a single strand of grey, and his teeth were even and white, the teeth of a man in his full flowering. On his head was the polished black ring of the Induna, and about his waist was a kilt of wildcat tails. Over that he wore a threadbare military-type tunic from which all insignia and buttons had been stripped, leaving small punctures in the fabric, some of which had been enlarged into rents, from which the lining peaked coyly. In the pierced lobe of one ear he carried an ivory snuff-box, and in the other lobe a snuff-spoon of the same material and a toothpick of porcupine quill. The language he used was very close to Matabele, but it preserved the ancient intonation and classic word structures of Zululand. So when Ralph asked, "Zulu?" the question was redundant, and the little man shot a contemptuous glance at Butzo. "Pure Zulu, not the treacherous house of Kumalo, of the traitor Mzilikazi who denied a king, and whose blood is now so watered by Venda and Tswana and Mashona, that they can no longer tell you if an ox grows horns on its head or on its testicles." Butzo bridled instantly. "Hark!" he cocked his head. "Do I hear a small baboon barking his boasts from the top of the kopjes?" The little Zulu grinned at him mirthlessly and took the stock whip from Ralph's sweaty hands. Then he walked to the tangled span with a jaunty step. He touched the big black ox on the neck. "How, Satan!" he greeted him, and at the same time baptized him Devil. The great ox rolled one eye at him, seemed to recognize his assurance, and immediately quietened. The little Zulu loosened him and took him forward, talking to him easily in a bizarre mixture of Zulu English and the Cape Dutch taal, and chained him into the lead position. He went back quietly and pulled the red ox out of the tangle by the rein about his horns. "Dutchman," he named him, for no good reason. "Come, you red thunder." And he put him into the lead file beside Satan, and called to them quietly. "Dancer, Satan, pull. Pakamisa, Dutchman, pick up the chain." Obediently, the pair of bullocks straightened their forelegs and leaned forward against the yoke. And a miracle happened. The long, heavy silver chain from the Disselboom came up straight and hard as an iron bar, and those animals on the ground were forced to lunge up onto their feet. Those that had backed out were pulled into the span, horns and heads pointing forward. In that moment, Ralph learned the single most important rule of the open road. Keep the chain straight and true, and all else is possible. Now the little Zulu moved with a deceptively casual air along the double rank of bullocks, touching and talking and wheedling. "Hey, Fransman, I can see by your wise and beautiful eyes that you were born to the wheel." And the sturdy black and white beast was led back to his position at the off wheel. It took 10 minutes, and then the Zulu put the long lash into the air. It hissed like a black mamba, and then snaked forward over the ears of the team, not touching a single hair as it fired explosively. The heavy wagon jolted. The white canvas tent that covered the rear half of the long body shook like the unfurling mainsail of a tall ship, and then it was rolling away smoothly. The Zulu crinkled his eyes at Ralph and called a question.
Yapi! Where? Which way?
Yakato! North! Ralph shouted back joyously. And despite himself, Butzo snatched up his war shield and assegai and whirled into a frenzied challenge dance, leaping and stabbing at a host of imaginary enemies, shouting defiance and ecstasy to all the world. The road to the Fahl River was the first leg of the journey, and the ruts were axle-deep, and red soil raw as a fresh wound, the dust a fog in the windless air through which it was just possible to make out the horns of the two-wheeler bullocks. The dust hid from Ralph his parting view of the sprawling town and its high stagings above the gaping hole, which had been his home and his prison for so many years. And by the time that the other traffic on the road had thinned sufficiently for the dust cloud to settle, they had made 5 miles, and the stagings might have been merely a distant line of dead thorn trees silhouetted against the sunset. The little Zulu called to his boy, who led the front oxen, and the child swung them off the road, and the high rear wheels bumped out of the ruts and then crunched through the crisp winter grass as the wagon rolled towards a spreading umbrella-shaped acacia, which would give them shelter and firewood for the night. Walking at the front wheel, Ralph pondered the two unexpected additions to his company. The child had come out of the curtain of red dust, naked except for the little flap of his mucha in front, and with the roll of sleeping mat and the cooking pot balanced upon his head. He had placed these meagre possessions on the tailboard of the wagon, and then, at a nod and a word from the Zulu, had taken the lead rein and plodded solemnly ahead of the span, his bare feet sinking ankle-deep in the powder dust. Ralph wondered how old he was, and decided he could not be more than 10 years of age.
"What is his name?" he asked the Zulu.
"A name?" the little boy shrugged. "It is not important. Call him Umfan, the boy."
"And what's your name?"
Ralph went on. But the little driver suddenly had urgent business at the head of the span, and perhaps the dust had clogged his ears, for he did not seem to hear the question. Ralph had to ask the question again after the outspan, when the Zulu was squatting beside the cooking fire watching Umfan stir the maize meal in the black pot.
"What is your name?"
And the Zulu smiled, as though at a secret thought, and then he said,
"A name can be dangerous. It can hover over a man like a vulture and mark him for death. Before the soldiers came to the royal kraal at Ulundi, I was called one thing."
Ralph stirred uncomfortably at the reference to the battle that had ended the Zulu War. The tattered tunic that the Zulu wore had once been the same dark blue as that of the Natal police uniform, and one of those rents in the faded cloth might have been made by the stabbing blade. Lord Chelmsford had sent the Zulu king and most of his indunas in chains to the island of St. Helena, where another emperor had died in captivity. However, some of his fighting chiefs had escaped from Zululand and now wandered homeless exiles across the vast continent. The driver wore the headring of an Induna.
"It was a name which men once spoke, carefully, but I have not heard it for so long now that I have forgotten it," the Zulu went on.
And again Ralph wondered if there was a legend still alive amongst the defeated Zulu, of a little Induna, smaller than the tall warriors he commanded, and wizened far beyond his years, who had led them in that terrible charge into the English camp below the hill of the little hand, Isilon Tswana. In the firelight, Ralph studied the Zulu's tunic again, and he told himself that it was unlikely that it had been taken from the corpse of an Englishman on the grisly field. Yet he shivered briefly, although the night was warm.
"Now you have forgotten that name?"
he encouraged, and the Zulu crinkled his eyes again.
"Now I am called Izasi, the Wise One, for reasons that should be clear even to a Matabili."
Across the fire, Butzo snorted disdainfully, then stood and walked out of the firelight into the darkness where the jackals piped plaintively.
"My name is Henshaw," Ralph told him. "Will you stay with me and drive my wagon all the way?"
Why not, little hawk?
You do not ask where I am going.
I need a road, Izasi shrugged. The one to the north is no longer or harder than the road to the south.
The jackal yipped again, but much closer this time, and Butzo paused, changed the assegai to his right hand, and answered the cry, cupping his palm over his mouth to give resonance to the sound, and then he moved on to where a small stone copy shone in the moonlight like a pile of silver bullion.
Butzo! The greeting was a whisper, soft as the night wind in the pale grass, and a shadow stepped from amongst the moon shadows at the base of the copy.
Kamuza, my brother!
Butzo went to him and embraced him, open hands upon his shoulders.
I have a stone in my belly, heavy with sorrow at this parting. We will share the road again. One day we will drink from the beer pot and fight with our shoulders touching,
Kamuza answered him quietly.
But now we are both upon the king's business.
Kamuza slipped the thongs that held his kilt in place, and it sagged heavily to his knees, leaving him naked.
Hurry, he said. I must return before the curfew bell.
Since the Diamond Trade Act, blacks were not allowed on the streets of Kimberley once the curfew bell had rung.
You were not marked by the police?
Butzo asked as he removed his own kilt and changed it with Kamuza.
They are everywhere like pepper sticks in the new spring grass,
Kamuza grunted.
But I was not followed.
Butzo weighed the fur kilt in both hands, while Kamuza swiftly belted the replacement about his own waist.
Show me,
Butzo said, and Kamuza took the kilt back from his hands and spread it on one of the flat, moon-washed boulders. He picked at the knotted thong that doubled the waistband, and as it came undone, he opened the secret pouch of soft, tanned leather, crusted with ceramic trade beads. The pouch ran the full length of the wide waistband, the opening concealed by the decorative beadwork, and the interior of the long pouch was divided into cells, like a wasp's nest. In each stitched leather cell nestled a large pebble that glistened with a slick, soapy sheen in the moonlight.
Count them, Kamuza instructed. Let us agree on their number, and let Lobangula, the great black elephant, count the same number into his mighty hands when you lay the belt before him at the kraal of Gubuluwayo, the place of the killing.
Butzo touched each diamond with his fingertip, his lips moving silently.
Amashumi amatatu.
30, Kamazu repeated.
It is agreed.
And they were all large, clean stones, the smallest the size of the first joint of a man's little finger.
Butzo tied the kilt about his waist, the fleecy tails of the bat-eared fox dangling to his knees.
It looks well upon you,
Kamuza nodded, and then went on.
Tell Lobengula, the great elephant, that I am his dog, and I grovel in the dirt at his feet. Tell him that there will be more of the yellow coins and the bright stones. Tell him that his children labour each day in the pit, and there will be more, many more. Every man who takes the road north will bring him riches.
Kamuza stepped forward and laid his right hand on Butzo's shoulder.
Go in peace, Butzo the Axe. Stay in peace, my brother, and may the days disappear like raindrops into the desert sand until we smile upon each other once more.
Isasi put the span to its first real test in the drift of the Fal River. The grey waters were barely flowing, but they covered the hubs of the tall iron-shod rear wheels, and the bottom was broken water-worn rock that clanked and rolled under pressure, threatening to jam the wheels and denying purchase to the driving hooves of the span. Yet they ran the wagon through under load, leaning into the yokes, noses down, almost touching the surface of the river, and the wagon tent jolting and rocking behind them. Until, under the steep cuts up the far bank, the rear wheels stuck and the wagon bed tilted alarmingly. Then Izasi showed his expertise. He swung the team wide, giving them a run at it, and when he called to his leaders and burst the air asunder with a 30-foot lash that tapered to the thickness of twine, they went in stiff-legged, jerked her clear, and took the load out of the riverbed at a canter, while Izasi pranced and sang their praises and even Umfan smiled. Ralph ordered an early outspan under the tall trees on the far bank, for there was good grass and unlimited water, and the next leg of the road to his grandfather Moffat's mission station was 120 miles, hard and dry going all the way.
"See, little hawk,"
Izasi was still rapturous over the performance of his span,
"see how clever they are. They pick a good patch of grass and eat it up. They do not wander from patch to patch, wasting their time and strength, as lesser beasts might do. Soon they will settle with the cud, and in the morning they will be strong and rested. Each of them is a prince among cattle."
"From tomorrow, we begin night marches," Ralph ordered. And Izasi's smile faded, and he looked severe.
"I have already made that decision," he said sternly. "But where did you ever hear of night marching, little hawk? It is a trick of the wise ones."
"Count me amongst them, then, Izasi," Ralph told him solemnly, and walked out of camp to find a place upon the river bank from which to enjoy the sunset. Here the banks of the Fal were churned into mounds and irregular hollows, the old river workings picked over by the first diggers and now abandoned and overgrown. It was a mass burial ground of men's dreams, and looking upon it, Ralph's high spirits that had buoyed his first day's trek upon the open road began to evaporate. It was the first day in his life that Ralph had been free and completely his own man. Walking at the wheel of his own wagon, he had woven dreams of fortune. He had imagined his wagons, 50, 100, carrying his cargoes across the continent. He had seen them coming south again, loaded with ivory and bars of yellow gold. He had seen in his mind's eye the wide lands, the herds of elephant, the masses of native cattle, the riches that lay out there in the north beckoning to him, warbling the siren call in his ears. He had been carried so high that now, as his spirits turned, they fell as low. He looked at the deserted diggings on the banks across the river, the vain scratchings where other men had attempted to turn this great brown slumbering giant of a continent to their own account. Then suddenly he felt very small and lonely and afraid. His thoughts turned to his father, and his spirits plunged lower still as he recalled the last words he had spoken. "Go then, go, and be damned to you." That was not the way he had wanted it. Zuga Ballantyne had been the central figure in his life until that day, a colossus who overshadowed each of his actions, each of his thoughts. Much as he had chafed under the shackles that his duty to his father had placed upon him, much as he had resented every one of his decisions being made for him, each of his actions ordered, yet now he felt as though the greater part of himself had been removed by some drastic surgery of the soul. Until this moment, he had not really thought of losing his father. He had not let the memory of their brutal parting cut him too deeply. Now suddenly this dirty, slow river was the barrier between him and the life he had known. There was no going back, now or ever. He had lost his father and his brother and Yanshurut, and he was alone and lonely. He felt the acid tears scald his eyelids. His vision wavered, played him tricks, for across the wide river course on the far bank was the figure of a horseman. The horseman slouched easily in the saddle, one hand on his hip, the elbow cocked, and the set of the head upon the broad shoulders was unmistakable. Slowly Ralph came to his feet, staring in disbelief, and then suddenly he was running and sliding down the sheer bank and splashing waist-deep through the grey waters of the ford. Zuga swung down from Tom's back and ran forward to meet Tom as he came up the bank. Then both of them stopped and stared at each other. They had not embraced since the night of Aletta's funeral, and they could not bring themselves to do so now, though longing was naked in the eyes of both of them. "I could not let you go like that," said Zuga, but Ralph had no reply, for his throat had closed. "It is time for you to go out on your own," Zuga nodded his golden beard. "Past time. You are like an eaglet that has outgrown the nest. I realized that before you did, Ralph, but I did not want it to be. That is why I spoke so cruelly." Zuga picked up Tom's reins, and the pony nudged him affectionately. Zuga stroked his velvety muzzle. There are two parties.